Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
I'm Angie, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi.
I'd like to thank Joe for inviting me to come and share with you. And I'd like to make amends to the ladies that were at the ticket booth when I got in yesterday about 5 o'clock for yelling at them. I'm here to stay. I'm not in too much danger. I'm getting too well. And I have a new gal with me, so she's seen me be wonderful and not so wonderful at the same time. And one of the freedoms that I have gotten in Alcoholics Anonymous, whether I like it or not, is to be myself, whatever that happens to be today. I'm feeling really good this morning, a little shaky, but I'm feeling good at being sober in this beautiful day. And I belong here. I belong in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I never belonged anyplace else before. And today I walk with the dignity of a sober woman alcoholic in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I am one of those that has conceded to myself that I am an alcoholic, and I am a real alcoholic. And for me that means that one drink is too many and 1,000 is not enough. I hope I have drank the last drink that I will ever drink, although we all have a daily reprieve contingent upon our spiritual growth. I just don't want that life anymore. I have found a home in Alcoholics Anonymous. And newcomer, you get nothing else from my story today. I know you will get the idea that I love this program and what has happened to me in the years that I have been here. I am not the same person that walked into this room many, many years ago. Although I've taken some inventories, and as I said, I'm not in too much danger of getting well or perfect or any of that new stuff or any of that neat stuff. On the last inventory I took was last March. And in this inventory, I realized and found out that all my defects of character are well intact. And they're just not as roaring that they used to be. But my sponsor always keeps me in line by saying things like, "How soon we forget." And she gave me a little plaque, and it says, "No, I want it today. If I wanted it tomorrow, I'd ask for it tomorrow." And that's my byline. I was born and raised in Orange County, and I'm still there. I had a slight geographical, but not too far. And in the days that I was born and raised there, I was born in a little Mexican community, a barrio. And in the days that I was raised there, we didn't know too many Anglos. They weren't too anxious to come in there either. And we used to join the gangs and beat each other up and call it fun. And we talk about it in the back pew of the Catholic Church on Sunday mornings, because all Mexican Catholics, we go to Mass on Sunday morning whether we need it or not. We're an awful lot like the Irish. The reason that I know we're like the Irish, because I have a girlfriend that comes from Ireland, and we've compared notes, and the only difference between the Irish and the Mexicans is they ate potatoes and we ate beans. That's the only difference. Why, we believe in drinking hard, fighting hard, loving hard, lots of babies, going to Mass and striking your chest, right, "Through my fault, through my fault, through my most grievous fault," and go on to do it again over and over and over again. I was born when they'd keep the mothers in the hospital a whole week, and when they came home with this baby, they still didn't have a name for me. The reason for that is because my daddy wanted to name me after his girlfriend, and my mother's narrow-minded. I had an older sister that was perfect. She was of the type that they always told her what to do, and she always did it, and she always did it right. And she screwed it up for me. They used to whip me every day and twice on Sunday because I never knew how to be good. Today I don't know how to be good. And I'm glad I don't have to be good today. All I have to do is be me. And I had a younger brother, and all he had to do was be there. Now, they were divorced when I was 7, and And she used to say things to me like, you're just like your father. And I knew what her opinion was of him. She didn't like him. So she would send me to the nuns so they could teach me to be a lady. Somehow the nuns' conception about being a lady never was very appealing to me then, and it's not appealing to me now. I was the type of the person that as soon as they said, thou shalt not, I may not have thought about doing it before, but as soon as they said, thou shalt not, I had an overwhelming desire to do it. And somebody dared me, and I raised the nun's skirt, see what she wore under all them clothes. And they 86'd me from catechism. And God, I got the whipping of my life, because I was always an embarrassment to my mother. But when I got to school the next day, the rest of the kids in school thought I was terrific. And it seemed to me that I was born with an emptiness in my soul, an absolute yearning, a longing, a hunger to be loved, to be wanted, and to be accepted. And as a little girl, I used to worship my mother and wanted her to love me so desperately that I would try to be the good little girl that I thought she wanted. But no matter what I did, it just never would come out that way because trouble seemed more exciting. And so when I got all that attention from the rest of the kids, it filled up something inside of me. I'm one that believes that I always had the pilot lit. All I ever needed was a fuel. Well, this came to pass, of course. I ran off to my daddy's when I was 12 because I had done so much bad over here that I had painted myself into a corner. So I just knew that if I could get to my daddy, everything gonna be all right. Now my daddy was over in the San Fernando Valley where he'd taken up light housekeeping with a lady with 8 kids and all he wants is one more. And he used to take people up north to pick grapes and prunes and we were fruit pickers. And you know, God made 2 kinds of Mexicans. That's fruit pickers and non-fruit pickers. I ain't no fruit picker. They try to make a fruit picker out of me. But we stayed beyond the season with the Gallo brothers, and they gave my dad a case of sherry wine. And somebody must have said, thou shalt not. Man, I had a big water glass of that sherry wine, and when it went down and hit my stomach, it went off like a firecracker, and everything felt good. It's just too bad something that good has to be wasted on social drinkers that don't appreciate it. Today and I've seen them bumper stickers. They say, I found it. Man, I found it. And if you happen to be like me, man, anything I found is going to be that good. I want to keep that feeling. And so I take some more of that and then it's the next day. Seems to me I always overshot the goal trying to keep the goal. And I came to. My hair stuck to my face where I'd thrown up all over myself because my clothes are torn where God knows what happened. And I had a sense of shame. I had a sense of being dirty that went all the way through me. And it seems that I started a lifetime of looking at people's eyes, terrified to find out what I had done the night before, and terrified not to know. And to have to be super good just to be even. That's the way it was with me. And I was a little girl, and I was already an alcoholic, and I didn't know that. I just knew, had always known, that I was not like them other people. Somehow, people had some secret magic to living, to being able to fit in, that I lacked. And I knew that you could tell it in me, and that I couldn't see it within myself. So I always had to check you out to find out what you expected from me. I came to my mother shortly after, and she didn't want me home. She said I was incorrigible. Her and my stepfather had decided that I couldn't live at home. And I was a little girl, not quite 14 at the time. And I looked at little girls 13 years old, and I was never that young. I was always old, and life was always over for me. And it was a terror. I had a knot the size of my fist where I wanted my mother to put her arms around me and tell me that she loved me. But I could not reach out for that which I needed so desperately. I put a wall around me, and I said, I don't care, I don't care, I don't give a damn. Now, we that build walls, yes, it does keep people out. I always knew how to push people away. But there was a loneliness inside over here with me. And I had you could have always cut my heart out with a feather. I was always so sensitive to rejection, and I always got it. I lived here and there and everywhere, wherever anybody would put up with me for a short time. And it was always a short time because somehow I messed it up by unwittingly or sometimes knowing. I became a party girl and palled around. This is the time when I palled around with the older crowds and with the gangs and stuff. And boy, we used to have parties every weekend. And we used to start drinking before the party. When you start getting the party ready, you got a drink to prepare for the party. I'd over-prepare, then they'd have to sober me up so I could have fun in the parties, so that they could have fun in the parties without having to have to take care of me. Sometimes they'd make it and sometimes they didn't. Sometimes they'd have to fish me out of the bathtubs where I'm drowning, and or take me away from somebody's boyfriend or husband or fighting somebody. And I was one of the original topless, bottomless dancers in Orange County. I don't even get paid for it. I don't even remember it. But you know, the girls were always so willing to tell me stuff like that the next day. And I used to beat them up, and then they didn't tell me, because I was terrified to know and terrified not to know. And that's why it took me a long, long time to be comfortable with the women in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I never felt like as good as. And I also don't know how to work, so I take up a vocation called burglary. It's still not very feminine. If anybody lived over in Lemon Heights in Orange County, I'd like to make my amends today. That need to be wanted, to be loved, and to fit in someplace turned to anger. And I developed a set of attitudes and values that said anything I did was all right, as long as it was me doing it, baby. There's only one sin, and that's to get caught. Well, the day came when I did. The state of California rescued me, and they sent me up to do a little bit of time. It was my first trip away from Orange County into the beautiful land of Ventura, school for girls. And I was going to go there for 9 months, but I need to be a part of, so I do 13 months. And because I don't know how to be good there either. And I got out as terrified, and I started to think. And you know, I just ought not to ever think much, so even sober. I said, go find me a husband, because I didn't have anything going for me. So I went out looking for a husband in places that husbands are not to be looked for. And I found one. And he was a dreamer like me. He would build them castles in the air, and I lived in them. And 3 months later, we were pregnant, and I was married in that order. And I married a heroin user. And you just don't live happily ever after with one of those. Very exciting, but not very happy. He had an idea of what a good Mexican wife should be, and I had an idea of what a good Mexican husband should be, and never the twain shall meet. And I got the scars to prove it, and he's got the scars to prove it. And he introduces me to little white pills with crosses on them. I don't know what they are, but I sure know what they do to me. Man, I had one eyeball over there and one over there, and I'd make little baby clothes all night long. You better be getting a little baby one all night long. Try to get it just right. Just take hours to get it just right. You can have more fun with Benzedrine and baby clothes. And it started out as exciting as it started out as a fountain of youth. And if I continue to drink and eat pills the way I did in those years, I'd have never come to Alcoholics Anonymous, because I live for the thrills and the excitement that would get me away from the reality of what I had. Because you see, by this time, I realized this man did not want to be married. But being as self-centered as I am, I knew he didn't want to be married to me, because he had discovered what was wrong with me, and he too was through. By the time they put that baby in my arms, and I looked at that baby, and I felt like finally, finally somebody belonged to me. That baby inspired feelings within me that nobody ever has before or since. The closest anybody has come has been her sister, but it was not like the first time. I loved my baby. I adored my baby. I would sit by the hour and just look at her and just love her. And I promised her I would never beat her, discard her, abandon her as I had been. And I meant it with every fiber of my being because I loved my baby. But I am a child in a woman's body. And I am an alcoholic. And I am a woman alcoholic. And when I drink, I got absolutely no choices and no rights. And I don't know this. Deep down inside of me, there was a spark that I of the woman that I am today. But I didn't have it then. I am an alcoholic. And when I drink, I got absolutely no choices and no rights. Anybody can use and abuse me in any way that they want. And I don't know that I'm being abused. I just think there is something horribly wrong with me. There is a monster that lives within me. And I took that baby and her sister to the places that children are not to be taken because I am an alcoholic. I left her daddy after the second one was born because I had her just a year later and I could just see this endless procession of babies. We didn't have much choice at the time. I guess there was an alternative. I wasn't willing to pay the price. And so I left their daddy because I needed to go out husband hunting again because God knows I needed somebody to take care of us, man. We were three now. And I went out and I fell in love. I didn't get married, but I fell in love. And when I fall in love, I fall in love all over my body. Every inch of me falls in love forever. I can't remember the names of some of the men I've fallen in love with forever. The faces change, it's the feelings that stay the same, trying to find that one that's going to make it all right, that's going to fill up all that loneliness, all that emptiness, all that terror inside of me. And the guy I fell in love with was called CB, and that was short for crazy bastard. Oh, it was he exciting. Somehow exciting men always were so appealing to me. They don't make very good husbands or boyfriends, but they're appealing. And if I'd have continued to drink that way, I'd have never come to Alcoholics Anonymous. But many a time I had to come home where there was not enough chemicals to kill what I had inside of me. When I would walk into that cold water shack, when I would turn on the light and the sink would be black with cockroaches, I mean thousands of them. And there would be mice on the filthy floor. And in that shack live those two little girls that the romance of being a mother had long since died. And the responsibility for them weighed heavy upon me. And I resented the total responsibility for these little girls. Their father, of course, never came around and sent money or anything. And I lived in terror and anger. And I felt guilty and ashamed that I had those feelings. I felt ashamed that I didn't have that warmth that I had had when I had held my daughter so short time before. And they had the big eyes. They had the big eyes where they were terrified. They would look at me and didn't know whether to hide or to laugh or to hug. And I didn't know how I was going to be either. They used to sit in front of the television without any noise. They were just looking at the pictures or the cartoons. They were terrified of making any noise because if they made any noise, the monster would come too. And I would come too and I would start screaming and yelling and then I would start hitting him. And once I started hitting him, I couldn't stop and I wouldn't stop. And I'd say to myself, for God's sake, stop, stop. It was like watching somebody else. And I wouldn't stop until there was blood gushing out of their mouth and their nose and something inside of me would be satisfied. And when a semblance of sanity would return and I would see what I had done to them two little girls, the guilt and the remorse was unbearable. I knew that I was the only protection them little girls had. Between them and the world. And yet it was me that they needed protection from. I've heard many women come into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and share that they've taken away their babies and they're very sad, and I know that you are. But in those days I used to think, for God's sake, will somebody please take these little girls and give them a normal life? Because I knew I couldn't. No matter how desperately I wanted to be what I had deep down inside, I could not be that person. I don't come and share this with you because I'm proud of it. I'm not proud of this. I'd rather not have my girls experience what I had to go through there. But it is part of my story, and it took me a long, long time to forgive myself for being this type of a child abusing mother. And it took me a longer time still to be able to share it with you, terrified as I was of your rejection. I come and share this with you because I realize that there possibly is somebody out there that has experienced the same thing, that has had so much trouble with the remorse and the guilt and the self-loathing that goes with treating your babies the same way you were treated and not wanting to do it. Today the slate is clean. So I come not only to free me by sharing this with you, but to free you if you are so inclined. Well, after a while, CB got tired of me trying to kill him. And he found another girlfriend. Violence, you see, was the only way I ever handled anything that didn't go my way. Anything that I couldn't fight or run from, I would try to kill it off. And then I started getting letters through the mail from my dopey husband that was someplace in Texas getting the cure. And he says, babes, this time it's going to be different. And so again he built them castles in the air, and again I lived in them because I didn't think that anybody else would want me anyway. Those men that wanted me, I didn't want them. I know today it was because I thought that anybody that would want me could not be worth much. Those that did not want me, I chased and cried over and drank over and mooned over. Because if they didn't want me, if I could catch them, it would mean that I was something. So when this guy wanted me back, I knew he was the father of my children, and I knew that he loved me in his own sick way. I guess he did. So we made the Mexican geographical. We moved 20 miles from Mama. Seemed I could never stand Mama, but, you know, I just always lived very close. Today I live 3 miles from her in a house that belongs to her. And we moved over to Mira Loma by Norco, this dolphin and I, and we bought an acre is what it was. And we bought the chickens and the horses and the turkeys, and we were going to be farmers, this dolphin and I, clean up our act. I even married him in the Catholic Church, and that's going to any length for a Catholic, especially since he was a Methodist. This is how determined I was to make the second marriage work. I was going to make it work no matter what. Never took into consideration that he might not want it that way. I just knew he did. And we even joined the PTA. That's everybody else we got. That was and then that first Christmas, I was a librarian, and this dolphin gangster was Santa Claus. If them folks had only known on whose lap their little darlings were sitting on, I'm talking about 1962, he had tracks up and down his arms, his legs, his neck. Well, it's a good thing they didn't know. But it isn't long before that life seems to get too tight, and I can't be the way them people look and maintain and do what I'm doing, and I'm a firm believer. You can place me in the best of circumstances, and sooner or later I got to create whatever is inside of me, because it's inside my skin I couldn't live. And today that's the measuring for me, when I can't live in my skin, when I'm starting to grow out of my skin. Of course, it didn't help that my neighbor made a pass. I thought my neighbor made a pass at my husband, and so I beat her up, and I found out that if you're like everybody else, you don't beat up people anymore. He starts making the run to Orange County to his connection. And I start making the run to the wineries, because if there's anything that Mira Loma had in those days was either dirt or wineries, 4 of them. And I'm a wino. I always liked wine. I think some of the wine I drank probably never saw the grape. And somehow my drinking changed. Where I used to be a party girl and loved the booze and the boys and the cha-cha-cha, my drinking changed, and I no longer wanted to be around people when I drank. I started drinking in my bedroom. Now is that time when I know what the words agony, despair and utter loneliness. I know those words. I learned them in Alcoholics Anonymous, where I've learned many words. But when I knew what they meant, I knew what that felt like. Because I used to lay in my bed in a fetal position and cry out in agony. I had come to the place in my drinking where I drank and I drank and I drank and my body was drunk and my mind was in agony. That I would come to in my own filth and crawl around and try to get to the bathroom, and sometimes I'd make it and sometimes I wouldn't. I would cry out for somebody to please love me and please help me. But you know, them people called relatives that long since quit coming around. They were tired of the physical and mental abuse that I would give them because, you see, they were always telling me how to be. I always knew how to be. There was never anything wrong with my principles and my values. I always had the upstanding values and principles. But it was my performance in comparison that was so poor. And the gap in between caused the agony. I could not be like them people. I couldn't be like what I wanted to be. And I just want to die. I just want to die because I know it's never, never, never going to be any better. I remember waking up on my 30th birthday and looking in the mirror and seeing an old hag. I remember looking at my neck to see if the flesh was hanging down. That's how old I felt. And I prepared to die in the only way that I know how to die. I saved my sleeping pills till I have enough. And I couldn't kill myself when them little girls were there alone because I couldn't do that. I waited until one of the times that he was home. And he was home watching television. And I went and told him I was going to die, and he says, okay, and goes back to watching television. So I went and took a bath, because I'm not taking very many baths by this time. And just in case I die, I don't want to be caught dead dirty. And you know how that goes. Ego to the end. So I guess I took enough pills to kill a horse. And I came to a couple of days later. And I realized I was alive. And I hated being alive. I came to on the loneliest day of my life, barring none. And I realized this man had been in bed with me both nights, and never once did he consider taking me to a doctor or to a hospital. He had saved the packages of them sleeping pills and showed them to my daughters that in case I died, the police would not blame him. And I can't drink, and I can't be sober, and I can't live, and I can't die, and I'm full of terror. The loneliest day of my life. That is why the love of the fellowship, the people in Alcoholics Anonymous, you, is so precious to me. Because I know what it is to be so alone that nobody gives a damn whether I lived or died. And it took me a long time to really believe that you cared, that you would say those words, I love you and I care to me. You loved me and you cared for me long before I responded and loved and cared back for you. Long before I learned to love and accept me. But because my higher power has always had his hand upon my life, even though I couldn't see it then, and I couldn't even look at that day for a long time without just bursting out into tears. You know, that very day there's a knock on the door, is a lady from the PTA. If there's somebody I don't want to see, it's a lady from the PTA. She was one of them dairy people. I don't know about you, what you know about Mexicans, but I lived in this valley. I didn't even know any Anglos till I was 22 years old. And we moved over to Okietown in Mira Loma, and she was from the dairy people. Them are the people that got cows running around in their backyard, and they get cleaned up just to stay at home, and somebody else cleans their house. And, you know, I hadn't even cleaned that house since I moved in it. But in a moment of weakness, I let her in, and I tell her my tale of woe. Now, you know I got a tale of woe. But I'm not telling her anything about me. I'm telling her that I tried to kill myself because of this SOB and all the promises he'd made me and how he'd done me wrong. And she listened to me, and she stayed with me. And throughout our conversation, she asked me if I ever heard of Al-Anon. And I had never heard of Al-Anon. But I got the idea that if I went there, he would straighten up. So she got me cleaned up and I went to Al-Anon. And somehow I didn't fit in Al-Anon. I felt a little bit like a whore within a nunnery. There was absolutely no identification between me and them square ladies. But you know, they were so kind and they smiled at me and I smiled back and I saw this lady again for the first time in over 11 years. And she's telling me how they used to laugh at me or with me or whatever. But we do that. You know we do that here. And it's with loving care. She says that I looked like I was startled with that smile. I go, but they loved me and they held me close. And after a while, I don't want to go there anymore because I feel uncomfortable with them people. But I don't know how to say no because I'm a people pleaser. I just go when she comes and cleans me up and takes me. And I don't listen too much, but I hear release. Now, I knew I couldn't divorce him because I'd married him in the Catholic Church. I had enough points against me. I'd go straight to hell. But I used to contemplate justifiable homicide because if anybody deserved to die, he would. It was a mercy killing. So when I heard release, I had a slight distorted way of thinking. I went home and I said, I'm going to learn to release you, you SOB, and then I'm going to kick you out. And if you don't leave, I'm going to pour hot wax in your ears. I had read that someplace and that sounded good. That sounded like something he deserved. So this guy used to sleep with his clothes on and a knife under the pillow in the front room in the rollaway bed. And I'd sit in a corner with a big black coat on and watch him. If he'd be a dozy enough, I'd go take a little peek, see how he's doing. He'd go, ah! God, that made me feel so good. Because he always thought he was so bad. And he would say unkind things to me also. He'd say, baby, I may have a monkey on my back, but you got an orangutan. And one day I came home and he was gone. He even took the socks that had holes in them. He wasn't planning on coming back. And he was always going or coming. He was either honeymoon or battle between he and I. Very, very exciting. It's kind of like, well, I'm not going to say that joke. It's being taped. But anyway. Anyway, I knew he wasn't coming back. And that same Al-Anon lady took me to an AA meeting. I had been to AA before, but it hadn't registered. You know, those years and those days all run together. I know I had gone to AA, I think. But anyway, I went to this AA meeting. It was the first one that registered. I walked into the young people's meeting in Pomona in August of 1964. And I sat in the back, and I listened to the sounds of Alcoholics Anonymous. I listened to that belly laughter, that smile that reaches to the soul, that shine in the eyes, and that happy talk. Those are the sounds of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the very first thing that attracted me to this program and to the fellowship was what was happening between you, because I knew I didn't have it. I knew that there was something there that I didn't have, had never had. I've often wondered, what is it, and where does it come from? And it came to me one day, and I consider it a spiritual experience, when I realized that that which happens in this room, these are just empty rooms, that which happens in here, we bring it with us, every one of us. And it intermingles and becomes a group conscience, a higher power, call it whatever you want. But there is a dynamic something that happens when you and I come together. And I wanted it so bad. I hungered for it. A newcomer, if you be like me, you don't have it. There was that spark way down inside of me that never died, but I knew I didn't have what them people had. A newcomer, if you be lucky like me, if you will be lucky like me, I just sat back there and I let it wash over my soul and I hungered for it. I just thought it's too bad I'm not an alcoholic. I don't know what it takes. As was mentioned last night, if there's another name for the disease that you and I have, it's called I Ain't Got It. And it programmed out the only thing that I understood. I looked around at all them sober, single, good-looking young guys, and I said, man, I'm going to get me one of those. Because I was never enough for me. I felt the man had the answer. And I got one. He was the sickest one there. He had to be. I got radar. But I'm one that believes that it takes what it takes, and that's what it took for me, because my higher power knew what would catch my attention. And so for 10 months, I came around as a visitor. In Pomona, in those days, they used to go around the room and everybody gave their name. And when it came to me, I'd say, I'm Angie and I'm a visitor. Nobody ever said you don't belong here. Somehow you understood I've been kicked in the teeth by life and rejected by everybody I'd come in contact with, and I couldn't have stood any more rejection. You put your arm around me and you said, keep coming back. Do you know what that feels like when you're used to people saying, keep on going, weirdo? You said, keep coming back. What a disappointment it was to me when I found out you were telling that to everybody. And I came around for all the wrong reasons. So seemingly. Someplace along the line, I must have started identifying because I started feeling guilty about drinking. So I stopped. It wasn't any problem for me to stop because I doubled up on the Miltowns and Benzedrine. And I got weirder. And so this guy all of a sudden decides that because I'm Catholic, he can't go with me. He wants to get rid of me, but he don't know how to do it. He tries gentleness. You just don't do subtle stuff like that with me. Because I'm not easy to get rid of. I didn't have a backup. Everybody's got to have a backup in order to give up the one you got before. So I moved to Pomona to be closer to the action. And I walked into a room one day, and there was somebody talking. There was a cute little boy. He just got out of YTS. He had big blue eyes and blonde hair. And he's talking, and he's saying he don't have a girlfriend, he don't have a surfboard, and he don't have a car. And I look at this cute young thing, and I think to myself, come here, little boy, I'll take care of you. And I did. I taught him everything he knows, and today he's practicing at someplace else. And I taught him well because he's still married. God and I educated that young man on sick broads. I hadn't had a sober day in 12 years. And I didn't know what it was to be without some kind of chemical inside of me. But after that relationship was over, he decided to become a minister. And I like to think that somehow in my small way, I helped push him over to God. Women, and I don't trust men, and that don't leave you much. But he was the first man that had ever been kind to me. He was the first man that had ever been gentle with me. And everywhere that he went, he wanted to take me with him. And he was so proud to be seen with me, and I wanted it. I'd have stayed there forever if I could have. Bill Wilson said in his writings that the good is the enemy of the best. And I was always willing to settle for some corner of seemingly good. I was that terrified too. I would never wait around for anything better. I would clutch and grab at anything that seemingly was good for me. I am grateful that my higher power sent that gentle young man into my life when I was so vulnerable that somebody could have ripped my guts out. He was the one that walked them streets with me when I couldn't stand to sit and sleep and do anything, where I didn't have any skin on and every nerve on my body was exposed. He was the one that would massage my legs whether the Charlie horses were so unbearable all I could do was scream. He was the one that held me close when the devil would be within me so bad that all I could do was scream and yell and throw and kick and scratch and pull and my hair and his and hit him, and he would hold me close and pray over me. I know today that you and I, today I know this, that you and I do not come together by accident. I truly believe that you and I come together by divine appointment. And that every relationship has its beginning and its parting. The only relationship that keeps on growing is a relationship that I hold with my higher power today that fills up all the empty places. When you come and step into my life, and I come and step into yours to learn from you and teach you. But when that appointment has been met, and you go on your way to another experience, you take a little bit of me with you, and you leave a little bit of you behind. And we're never the same, because our lives have touched. And even today, it's not easy for me to say goodbye, because I always want to clutch. But it's so much, it gets easier and easier and easier to know that my higher power walks with me all the time, but I didn't know it then. I clutched and I maneuvered and manipulated and did everything I could to stay in bondage with that young man. And we walked together for 6.5 years. We got drunk together after 6 months because everybody gets well in 3 months, don't they? I mean, I did. Then in 3 more months, it took me to get bored with hearing the same old jazz here. I realize today that this program is designed for me to find out about the most fascinating person I know. Guess who that is? You know, I'm not coming to this meeting to find out about the fascinating person you are. I'm too self-centered for that. I know this program is designed for me to get an everlasting unfoldment. And it has been that way with me, but it wasn't then. Today, that's also an indication when I'm getting lax in my program is when I start getting bored. And it's a symptom and it's a signal. And I'm grateful that I can see that in me today. Took me 3 more months also to not find any other Mexicans in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd go into rooms and I'd say, they don't like Mexicans in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm their token Mexican. They say, well, maybe Mexicans aren't alcoholics. Maybe just we gringo genes. So when God got drunk, so did I. And though that was not my worst drunk, it was my most hopeless one. I guess I thought I had to build up some drinking time, but it wasn't that way. I took up right where I left off, where I drank and I drank and I drank and my body was drunk and my mind was in agony, and again I started wanting to die. And I can't drink and I can't be sober and I can't live and I can't die. And I came back because one of you went out and got me. I don't know that I had the guts to come back because, you see, I always had to hide who I was. But you know, when we drink, it's one thing for me to know I'm a loser. It's another thing for you all to know, and I knew you knew. I came back because this man brought me back. And the miracle for me is not that I've come to Alcoholics Anonymous, because hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people come and don't stay. The miracle for me is that last December the 22nd, I celebrated my 13th birthday. That is a miracle for me. I am a walking, talking miracle of this program. And my journey began. And it's been quite a journey. Quite a journey. An exciting journey. Where before I thought I was a little alcoholic, now I thought I was too alcoholic. And they start these meetings all wrong for people like me. They start reading something that says, rarely have we seen a person fail. I don't know about the rest of you, but when they say rarely, I know somebody ain't going to make it. And then they say they are such unfortunates, they are not at fault, they seem to have been born that way. Man, I'm screwed, I was always that way. My mother will tell you I was that way when I was 2 years old. But a little further on down it says, and then there are those that have grave emotional and mental disorders. I am so grateful they have that in there because my sobriety sounds like some people's drunkalogue, I kid you not. I just don't live in a cold, dark room without any structure, without any guidance, without anything and anybody to ever depend on, and all of a sudden come into this program and feel a part of. Wasn't that way with me. I lived in terror, and it took me a long time to get out of the terror stage into the frightened stage, into the believing stage, and then into the trusting stage. God knows I don't want to grow wings and fly away. But in the beginning, they know more than me, everybody. And to me, it was a status symbol to be called an alcoholic. I had been called so many other choice words. And because a little further on down, it says many of them do recovery if they have the capacity to be honest. That is the reason that I'm here with you today. Now, I'm not presumptuous to stand up here and tell you I got the capacity to be honest because I really don't know. I know that deep down inside of me, I want to be honest. The essence of my life today is my sobriety. And the yearning of my heart is to do whatever my higher power has spared me to do. Because I am one of those that believes that I have been spared. I know because I've been had an opportunity to check people out. I know that the idea of surrender does not come to every alcoholic. Before I knew this, I used to say things like, they ain't hurt bad enough. They ain't honest. saying in essence, they are not doing it like me. But I've checked people out. But you and I die with a disease of alcoholism without ever knowing that we can have a daily reprieve. I've checked us out and we don't die easy. We die with a belly full of liver, yellow eyes, and we throw up our throats and our stomachs and we say, thanks a lot. I'm never going to do it again. And the next time we come back and it's too late. We lose control of our bodily functions and somebody else has had to see our degradation of our disease. That's how we die. And I've checked them out. I wasn't more honest, more open-minded, more willing than they. But I have been spared because my higher power has given me the idea of surrender. And the responsibility weighs so heavy upon me that I know that I have a daily reprieve contingent upon the maintenance of my spiritual life. And when they knew more than me and I looked them up in pedestals, and a lady volunteered to be my sponsor. I ain't asking any of them ladies to be my sponsor. I'm scared of rejection. And she volunteered and she said, I got to give up that young man or one day he would give me up if he'd stay sober because our heads were in different places. That I had to stay home and learn to be a mother. Or one day my girls would grow up and that we'd have no communication and I'd be sorry. And I thought about what this lady told me. I have never been able to live without a man. Some man to hold me close and make that lonely, horrible something go away, at least for a little while. And I didn't know how to be a mother any more sober than I did when I was drinking. I had a lot of trouble in the first 5 years of my sobriety with violence, with depression. And I could never predict my behavior. And I was still doing many other things that I had done when I was drinking with those two little girls. So I thought about what this lady told me. So I did the most reasonable thing for me. I gave up the sponsor because I knew how to live without her. She made me feel guilty. I didn't tell her I was giving her up. I just backed away from her and smiled a lot. And so when I would look up at these people, and then after a while, I don't like some of you. Then I can't stand some of you. Then I hate one. God, there isn't anything like going into a room with 100 people, 99 you like and one you hate. God, I couldn't see anybody but this guy. And he didn't know nothing because he went to a meeting every night. I'm a newcomer. I'm supposed to go to a meeting every night. I went to a meeting every night for the first 2 years, and I used to call it dedication. Today I know that the alternative was to stay home with me. And then I'd hear about resentments are the number one offenders. They kill more alcoholics. So I didn't want to drink anymore. So I would go to some of you that look like you know knew what you're talking about. And I put a smile on my face and I didn't want you to think I was a bad person. And I didn't tell you I didn't like one of you. I just said, how do you get over resentments? And you say, turn it over easy. Does it? This too shall pass. One day at a time, go home, read the book, keep coming back and don't drink. So I went home. I would go home and I'd do all this neat stuff. And then I'd come back the next night and it didn't work. So I go to somebody else. I didn't want to go back to you because you know how dumb I am. So I go to somebody else and you say, turn it over easy. Does it? This too shall pass. One day at a time, go home, read the book, keep coming back and don't drink. After a while, I get the message. You don't know the answer either. I don't know what else to do. So I just keep on keeping on keeping on. You know, that's the way it is. Just keep on keeping on keeping on. That's all I've ever done. Just stand up and wipe myself and try again and start again. And do all those things that they told me. And one day there was a tragedy that this man had in his life. And all that resentment, all that intolerance melted away. And I didn't know where it went. I just knew that I had love and compassion for this man. And when I went and hugged him and cried with him, they were real tears. And I learned about the patience and the tolerance of one drunk for another. Because you see, there's times when I have to have patience and tolerance for you. And there's times that you have to have patience and tolerance for me. And where do the likes of you and I go where people will have tolerance for us? I have never found anybody that would have patience and tolerance for me before you came into my life and taught me to become a soft person. Well, I married that young man feeling that the woman had cursed me, and that would always come about, that what she had cursed me had come about. And the day came when my higher power said, it's time, it's time, it's time. My girls got big, they started going through the same route I had been, and I would get on my knees and I'd say, God, spare my babies. If nothing else, God, spare my babies. I had that home and the man that loved me and my children, and it was going through my fingers. My children were not, they hated me. And I came home one day and they were so loaded, we had a big fight. I hit them and they hit me back, and they reminded me of the horrible mother I had been and all the many things that they had seen, and I died inside. They ran off. I had one that ran off to Ohio. I always couldn't stand my mother. Only went 20 miles. I didn't even know any Mexicans in Ohio. And I had one that was going to live in a commune, and she didn't tell me where she was. She came home one day, had a burn the size of a silver dollar on her chest where people had been putting cigarettes out on. The one I had held in my arms so many years ago, so close, with so many hopes and dreams. And she could detest me. I went into a horrible depression. I had a nervous breakdown. Again, I contemplated an attempted suicide. That young man went and took me to the psycho ward, went home, packed his clothes, and left me. And everything that I ever feared came about, and I felt devastated inside. And the only reason that I stand before you today is because my higher power has had other plans for me. And it is because of the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. They came and held me up and shared your God and your faith and your strength with me. When I had nothing going for me, I didn't want to drink. It never even entered my mind. I just wanted to die. I knew that I was a failure, drunk or sober. And it isn't anything for me like devastating pain to make all the walls come down. And it is from the women in Alcoholics Anonymous that came around me and held me up that I learned to be a woman. I was finally able to share the secrets of my heart with you. And you shared the secrets of your heart with me. And I realized we were not so different. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, we become each other's mamas. I had never had a mama, not really. But you've mamaed me many, many times. You didn't tell me turn it over as you does it, do you, all that stuff. You knew I knew that. You just hugged me and you loved me and you kissed me and you took me home and you listened to me whine. And when I hurt, I whine. Oh, and I whine loudly. And when I use you up, I go whine at somebody else. And all the whining that I did. It is from the men in Alcoholics Anonymous that treated me like a lady that I learned to be a lady. I was finally able to be honest and go to one of you named David. I said, Dave, what is wrong with me? What is it that is within me that you can see, that other people can see, that I cannot seem to form a one-to-one relationship, not even with a beautiful man like Bruce? You held me close and you said you are a beautiful, warm, loving lady. And one day you will know the reason. It was the very first time that I was able to accept there was anything good about me. You see, I had heard those words before, but I had never believed them. And this time something sunk in. So I went home and got on my knees and I said, okay, God, I know the reason. Bring him back. And he didn't come back. So I thought about them people that I loved, and all I wanted to be was be good with them, and I couldn't be. I thought, screw them all, let them do what they damn please. I'm tired. I don't know about the rest of you, but for me that means surrender in the only language I understand. And in those days I went to a meeting in Brentwood, and there was a big sign on the wall that said, God helps those that don't try to take over his job. And I made peace with my higher power. I said, okay, God, I'm never going to be happy again. All you ever want me to do is work with a sick woman drunk and let them puke on me. All right, all right. And I threw myself completely and absolutely into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous without any reservation, knowing I'm never going to be happy again. And I don't know about your higher power, but mine has a weird sense of humor. When I want something so bad, oh God, just this one time, 10 Hail Marys and 10 Our Fathers every Sunday, it don't come. As soon as you say, oh, screw it, here it comes, here it comes. Sometimes I try to fool him and tell him it ain't all that important. Somehow he always knows. When I got to the other side, not before, when I got to the other side, I touched the power and I touched the strength within me that filled up all them empty places, and I realized that nothing and nobody could ever defeat me because I had touched the power that stayed within me and has sustained me. And it keeps on growing. And it keeps on getting better and better and better. Today I am totally dependent upon my higher power for my happiness. Even when I take a little few detours, I come back. In my drinking days, I used to read the Bible a lot, looking for how to become a lamb instead of a goat. And I read something that says, all things work together for good for those that love God. And I have changed it a little, of course. I want to rewrite the Bible. I have put down all things work for good for all those that have taken the third step. And I have taken that third step. And I know that my higher power will see to it somehow or another that I don't stray too far because he has spared me. And I know this. My kids came back one at a time. I don't even care if they come back anymore. And they stayed with me till they were 20 and 21 by choice. And they went to work and they put me through school and today I'm self-supporting to my own contributions. And sometimes they're both there at the same time and one sits on one side of me and the other one sits on the other side of me. And we cry and we love and we cry and we love because we're criers and lovers. And I'm overpaid for anything that I thought I missed out on. Hello, Pancho. And I wish it could be like that all the time, but it's not. It's not. Just most of the time, which is enough. And remember that baby, the one I had held in my arms so many years ago with so many hopes and dreams? She turned out to be a 200-pound Mexican mama that married her a skinny little Okie. About 120 pounds, and they look like the odd couple. But this man treats my daughter the way I would want a man to treat my daughter. I often wondered what would happen the next time another crisis comes into my life as comes to every person's life. The last time I had reached down and there was mush. I had that opportunity, and I consider it an opportunity because time softens all blows. You remember my sister, the perfect one, the one my mother had always held up, always, and said, this is my daughter, Alice. Get back there, Angie. She was hitting the bottle and the pills pretty heavy and had acquired a boyfriend, even though neither one of them had bothered for divorce. And I went to see her one day. She chose to put the car in the garage, and she chose to take her life. And it was my destiny to be the one to find her. And I could not believe what was before my eyes. I wanted to explode. But somehow in those days, I hit the bedrock of my sobriety. And underneath my grief was a solidness that said, God is the only giver and the only taker of life. She chose to go, and he let her go home. How many times did I want to die, and it seemed I could never die? And she just chose to go and went. Newcomer, I don't come to teach you, I don't come to share or to give you nothing or to save you. I come to share my life with you because I believe this is one of the reasons that I have been spared. Because I am God's melody of life and he sings his song through me. He sings his song through me. Someplace, somewhere, somebody out there needs to hear the places I come from, the screw-ups I do sober, and that I'm still here with you sober. Now, because his hand is always light when it's heavy, 2 weeks after my sister killed herself, I became a grandma. God, and do I love being a grandma. I have been a failure as a mother. I never knew how to be a mother. But I'm good as a grandma. I mean, I can hold myself up to any grandma. After that baby was a year old, the daddy was sent to Alaska. He's in the service, and I don't even know any Mexicans in Alaska. Thank you, God. While over there, they had another one. And you remember Carter was doing diplomacy by shuttle or whatever he was. I've been doing grandmother by shuttle. I'm so broke. I'm so grateful for credit cards in one hand, but Jesus, am I broke trying to pay off them trips to Alaska. But there isn't any feeling like it. For me to walk off of the airplane and a little voice yell out, that's my grandma. And I get over there and them little arms go around my neck and just clutch me and them wet kisses and somebody saying, this is my grandma. Hey, this is my grandma. I'm telling you, I'm good. Sometimes the television comes on and the commercials are there and she grabs me and says, Grandma, buy me that. She thinks Grandma and Santa Claus are synonymous. I'm telling you, I'm good. And because in my life it's either chicken or feathers, they were just here recently and they stayed with me 6 weeks. It got to the place that I didn't have any place to rest. I would go into the bathroom and lock the door to at least get away for a little while. And there's a little voice saying, what you doing in there, Grandma? I OD'd on grubby hands, sugar on the floor, and grubby little faces that give you wet kisses. And I said, oh, my God, when they're leaving. And it's really a lot to be said with what you've done in my life to tell you that they stayed with me 6 weeks. And never once did I have an argument with any of them, even the tiny ones. And even my son-in-law, who I've tolerated. I have a program, and that's why I tolerated him. He doesn't have a program, and he just was naturally kind to me. Even though I was tolerating him. He did all the work around the house, and I said, doesn't this guy know I don't like him? And if there's such a thing as buying my love, this guy did it. They had a big fight while they were there, and he was going to go, and I put my arms around him, and I said, Jim, let them go. You stay here. And that made him feel good because he knew he'd arrived with me. And not that I'm so important to impress, but it can be a lot easier if I like you. You know, the happiest things that have happened to me today is that some of you love me so much that you call me sponsor. They're always afraid I'll move away or something. You know, that just feels so good to be wanted and needed and loved. To have people want me around, to have people ask me to come and share my life with you. I'm always, always amazed that you should want me. I know that my self-respect is the slowest thing that has come, my self-acceptance. My ego is so great, sometimes I want to throw me away, but you don't let me. In the big book, in page 83, it promises me many, many things, and I got it on my wall. But the one that it catches my eye, where it says, I will comprehend the word serenity and I will know peace. If you were a person like me that laid in a bed, reefing, in a fetal position, and can't live and can't die, crying out in agony, and can't drink and can't be sober. For me to say that I have learned what it means to comprehend the word serenity and I will know peace. There is no road that leads from there to here except my higher power unravel it without much help from me. I have been allowed to touch sobriety because he has touched me. Newcomer, may he do the same for you. Thank you for having me here today.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.